Blog Talk Radio.
Second episode, and we will be talking to, as soon as the music stops, we will be talking to Miss Sunday Coffran Taylor. Are you there, Sunday?
I certainly am. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to
All
be
right.
here.
Yeah, so we have a slight delay, but I'm sure everything is going to work real well. I panicked for a minute because my switchboard screen just totally went black, and it's like, ah! So, are you as excited about this discussion as I am?
Oh, absolutely. I have a little stage fright, which is funny because I'm nowhere near a stage, but I'll get over it because I can talk.
Why don't you tell our listeners what you said today that you were going to have to do before the show?
Which?
Well, you said you had...
Oh, that I had to clean the house before the show, yeah. Because I'm sitting in my den, and I want to make sure that it's clean so that I can be on the radio. My 12-year-old said, well, Mom, last I checked, people can't see you on the radio. I was like, I know. It's neurotic. I get it.
Wow. Well, we're glad that whatever it takes for you to be comfortable, that you're creating that on your end, and surely, hopefully, on this end, we will create that sense of comfort for you as well. So, before we start, let's see who we have listening in our chat room so that we can make sure that people are all hooked up. And, okay, I see three people so far, so okay, good. I just want to make sure that people can actually chat with us. And also I've asked for other former foster youth who may be on the call who might, some of your stories might resonate with them, that they can actually call in and perhaps share some of their similar experiences. So
oh,
first of all,
more
right, oh yeah, all at one time. So first of all, tell us, we know that this program is geared toward addressing issues faced by children in the foster care system, and the majority of our guests are former foster youth who are now adults who have had an opportunity to reflect and begin to start to heal and make some sense, if any, of the experiences that they've had. So tell us a little bit about how you actually entered the foster care system and how old were you?
I was 11 years old and in sixth grade when I decided to homeschool myself for my entire sixth grade year. I have some learning disabilities. I was very uncomfortable in school. I'm dyslexic, so the teacher would call on us to read out loud. And being that my mother was never home, I decided that I should stay home and educate myself. So And also in the midst of that, my mother, who was in foster care and adopted out at 12, was struggling with taking care of us, trying to give us back to my dad, and he didn't want us, and dropping me off at home or runaway shelters and different facilities, and trying to get me, you know, like trying to get anybody but her to kind of take care of us. She was a little overwhelmed. So as that was going on, I wasn't going to school. So eventually I did go to court. And the judge asked me what I wanted to do. And I had been advised by my social worker that was working with us at the time to ask to be placed in state custody because the situation at home was not going to change, and I was not going to be parented, and I was not going to have food or transportation. So that is what we did, and that is where I went to when I went into the foster care system.
Okay, so was the social worker someone that had been referred through CPS, or was it someone from your school? How did she get involved?
Well, at first I was being taken, like I said, to runaway shelters. My mom would drive me to the runaway shelter.
Okay, so the staff
and drop
at the
me
shelter.
Off. So the staff
okay.
at the shelter. And then the final social worker was actually through a hospital. That my sister had also been placed at the runaway shelter. This had been going on with both of us for a couple of years, so these people were all very familiar with the situation. And so the final social worker that went to court with me was through a hospital, and that's where, you know, she just said, this is going to continue on. You're going to keep being dropped off. You know, we've got to get you made a ward of the state, and that is how it happened. So, which is again a mask I don't like to wear. I usually don't like to talk about the being dropped off at the hospital part, but it is the truth.
Right, right. And your mother, was she experiencing depression or any type of substance abuse? What was going on with your mom that she was feeling overwhelmed? I understand she had been through a divorce.
She had been through a divorce. My mother was also, like I said, my mother was abused, very seriously abused before she was removed from her father's custody. She was adopted by my grandparents when she was 12 years old. Their daughter had just died, so they replaced their daughter with my mother and her sister.
Keep our stories to not get entangled, because you're going to tell her life story and get it tangled with yours. So I just want to say what was going on
right.
with, at that moment.
Right. And
feeling overwhelmed with parents.
Exactly. Well, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is, because she had her own scars from foster care, from adoption, that had not been resolved. She has been a recovering alcoholic. We talked last night. She really has no problem with me talking about this. She was a recovering alcoholic, or she has been for a long time. When they first got divorced, my mother was drinking. I think even when she didn't, she kind of replaced the alcohol with the support group. So she was completely not home from 6 o'clock in the morning until midnight. She just got carried away with her own life. And I was 10, so I needed a mother.
Right, right. And she was in need of mothering herself. Okay, so you went into the system at the age of 11. Do you remember any of the feelings you may have experienced at that time?
I was very angry. I was very angry. I kept getting dropped off from one parent to the next to runaway shelters. I was very angry. It was very clear. I was, you know, at least in my mind, they were trying to get rid of me. And for a child, it's very painful. It was very painful to me. And I was very angry about it, because I really, up until the point of the divorce, I had had a very pretty normal upper middle class suburban life. So nobody I knew had parents dropping them off and trying not to take care of them. And I didn't really, even as a kid, I really didn't think I was asking for that much, you know. to have parents. I really didn't think that that was that much, but it, you know, obviously neither one of my parents at the time wanted to stop fighting, wanted to stop carrying on with their own lives. You know, they got divorced, they were moving on. Unfortunately, they had these children that were standing in the way, and neither one of them thought that should stop them. And I was very angry, and I was very hurt, and
right.
I'm still very hurt. It's actually, I'm a little choked up thinking about it, because it, for a 10, 11-year-old, that's devastating to know that neither one of your parents want you.
Right. Okay. And even with the parents, you know, you said they didn't want to, they probably didn't even know how to if they wanted to. But as an 11-year-old child who was feeling hurt and pain and probably confused, and I even heard a little bit of embarrassment in there, so you went into the foster care system, and your first home was probably an emergency-type setting, and then you went into something else that was probably intended to be a little bit more permanent. Do you remember what that experience was like?
Well, the first permanent placement I went into was a group home in Ann Arbor called South Seventh House. And I do remember that. I remember my first day walking in the door. It was overwhelming. And again, I was angry. I was disgusted that I was there in the first place, because I truly felt like I didn't belong there, which I'm guessing I'm probably not the only one that's ever walked through the door feeling like I'm not one of these people. But I do remember my first day, and I do remember, you know, there was a kind of, you know, a kind of sniffing out of the new girl, and I remember being very intimidated by that. And my best friend to this day I met that day, so that was a good thing.
So feeling intimidated, hurt, feeling, as the kids would say, scoped, that you were being scoped and sized up. Mm-hmm. Did you let anybody know what you were really feeling? Because I also want to say that you use the word angry a lot, and that's definitely clearly understood. And as a therapist, you know, one of my beliefs is that, or at least I would say one of the theories that I adopted in my work in psychology, is that anger is really a superficial emotion. It's the outside, the emotion, which covers usually something more vulnerable. But you were able to say you were feeling intimidated, overwhelmed, and hurt. Was there anyone that you could talk to that you told how you really felt inside?
I don't really think at that particular time. I don't really think, as we're talking, walking into the doors of my first placement, I don't think so. I think I was a whole lot more comfortable with the anger. I don't think I was comfortable with the sadness or the fear or the sense of loss. You know, I had lost a lot by that time in my young life, and a lot of things that were very important to me that, of course, at, you know, 10 years old, you don't think you're going to lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think you're going to lose your family, your house, your, you know, just everything, my religion, my gymnastics, you know, every normal thing that I had in life was gone.
Totally snatched from up under you. Okay. So you went in, and so the face that people saw was not the hurt child or the intimidated child or the overwhelmed child. They saw what?
Oh, they saw a very angry, very tough, very sarcastic, very biting. I called my friend who was there that day, the first day I walked into my first real placement, and I was like, "Well, you know, I'm going to talk about the mask. What do you think? You know, what do you think my mask was?" And she was like, "Oh, you were a really mean white girl. You were the really mean white girl." I was like, "Oh, okay. Thanks for being honest."
A mean white girl.
a mean white girl.
Okay.
So you were mean. So
that was your mask. And so that means the mask of that mean white girl had to show up because?
Well, I think for one thing, I was intimidated. I was a stranger walking into a strange place. Also, you know, I was a kid, I want to say at that point, I believe I was 11. I was a kid that didn't go to school. And it wasn't even like a defiant not going to school. It was I didn't go to school because I didn't have to. And so I had a roommate that, you know, was a 14-year-old prostitute. I was in a situation with other people, and again, I guess it was arrogant of me, but I didn't belong there. I didn't belong there. I didn't belong here with, you know, the prostitute or the person that got caught shoplifting or, you know, and there were some other kids there who just had family problems. But, and I felt very intimidated. I felt very intimidated. And it was I'm gonna get you before you get me. And I'm going to make sure if you try to get me that you're going to regret it. So, not like I was physically violent, you know, it's always been my mouth. My mouth has always been, you know, usually my mouth is intimidating enough you wouldn't want to push it too far, you know, because if I can be that in your face verbally, you know, I must be able to back it up, which I'm totally not, but people don't know that.
Uh-huh. So that was the other mask, too, as being, you know, unbeatable. And I was asking you that showed up because we know that mask actually did serve a purpose for you. It helped you to survive in that environment and in that phase in your life. What purpose did that serve for you? You sort of said it, but I'm trying to get a little bit more succinct. The mask was...
The tough girl, the street girl, I call it Tamika. It was truly to keep people at bay. It was to keep people off at a safe distance, and to protect myself, you know, emotionally as well as physically. So.
Right. Well, that was your protector. It was meaning that nobody else could get underneath to see what was really going on with you, to cause you any more hurt, to cause you any more harm, to cause you any more embarrassment. That was it. You weren't having it.
I was mad as hell, and I wasn't going to take it anymore. And that was kind of where I was at. Can I say that? On Blog Talk?
Of course you can. You want to say it again?
Oh, okay. but it was. I was mad as hell, and I wasn't taking any more from anybody. And I had, you know, either consciously or subconsciously made that decision that I'm done. I'm done.
Right.
I've been pushed around enough.
And even though the anger, to some extent, was very real, very much present, it also covered up all of the other things that you felt. So that became really how people probably labeled you, did you say?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
How they treated you or did not treat you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I will say there were some people who realized I probably wasn't half as tough as I was making myself out to be. But, no, I think I did get labeled as, you know, the angry kid. And, I don't think I was nearly as angry. Well, I mean, I was angry, but I don't think I was nearly as tough as I portrayed myself.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. And the reason I am even having this discussion is because in my work with young people, I feel so protective of the labels that are placed on our kids, and, you know, they are considered to be, you know, defiant, deviant, unruly, non-compliant, and then they get labeled with all of these psychological terms just because someone needs something to write on a piece of paper to get paid for seeing them, and then we won't even talk about the pharmaceutical industry. But I think that when we talk about what's really going on with our young people, it's so important to look underneath the mask. And that's my whole thing about getting to the heart of the matter, because the average person would just look and see just this little mean, little mouthy girl, and it was hard for anyone to get connected to you. But you said there were some people who did see underneath that. And who were some of those people? You may not have to name them by name unless they might be listening and you want them to acknowledge them. But who were some of the people, what were their roles and positions, and how did they get under that mask with you?
Well, and I was very lucky, and in this particular placement, we had what you call a one-on-one, which was your personal staff. And so she, her name, I'll use her first name, was Joyce. She was very much understood, and she is one of the most, I've got several, I mean, I call them everyday angels, and I was, in my opinion, very fortunate that I had people that looked out for me and loved me in spite of the fact that I was a little mouthy, angry kid. One of the things that Joyce used to always say, and it's always stuck with me as a message, is sometimes kids are just kids. Just because they're in placement or they have an issue doesn't mean that they are the issue. Sometimes kids just do stuff because kids do stupid stuff. And that was a really important message, I think, that I got at that point, because you're talking about labels, and I think that she was definitely one of those people that just wasn't buying the labels. These were, you know, we were kids who were ripped out of our homes. No doubt we're angry. Sometimes they're just kids. So she was good. And then, like I said, I have my best friend throughout my life, I met there, and we've always supported each other. You know, there's also an issue with that we're both, you know, have a little broken place in our heart. So sometimes we can't help each other as much as we want because we're still healing, or it has been that way through the past. But she's always been somebody that I have been able to be myself with. Well, after the first day, we had a little throwdown, but after that, we were fine.
A little throwdown. Haven't heard that term in a while. So,
well, it was back in the day.
Right. The first person, Joyce, because what I hope to be able to, for listeners to walk away from with this interview, especially those who have not had the experience of being in the system, want to be able to help, and I say to the village, people don't know how to connect. And so I want to be able to give them some concrete things that they can do to help touch the heart of our young hearts, of our young people who are really feeling the need to stay behind that mask, to share with them. And so it's one of the things that I hear you say that Joyce did, she actually spoke some things to you that validated your experience and took away the ugly label. She was telling you that you're not the problem.
Right. And I will say that too. She was very clear that I was not the problem. And there was a lot of blame, and there, believe it or not, still all these years later with my parents, there's a lot of blame on me. And she was one of the people, and she did actually confront my parents that, you know, when your 11-year-old doesn't go to school for an entire year, you know, that's your problem, not theirs. I think that helped me a lot, because even though there was a lot of blame and denial and not taking responsibility of my family, it did let me know I wasn't just a bad kid and that not everybody. Incapable, and that I was just a kid. I was just a kid, and I was just a really angry kid. But, but there were reasons for that, and she, you know, she understood that and validated it. And I think it was huge as far as maybe not at the time, but as I've grown and matured, I think it did help heal. Obviously, you know, at the
I said most definitely. What is it? Do you think in her? Her ability to see that enabled her to be able to see that, because the average person sometimes isn't able to immediately say, this is not, you know, the child is not the problem here, even though the child is acting out. And I, a lot of times people, you know, will look at me and say, well, you just, you know, you smother the children, you spoil them. And my thing is, it's not necessarily condoning the behavior, but it's understanding where it's coming from. So what do you think it was about Joyce that allowed her to let you know that your feelings were well understood and I'm sure perhaps maybe helped you to deal with the behaviors in a slightly different way?
I am not sure. I know she came from a really big family herself, and I think, honestly, she was just an exceptional person. I think she was a very strong-willed person, and maybe she saw a little bit of me with the mouth in herself, maybe, at her age. So I think she understood that. Not that she was mouthy, but, you know, she was a very strong woman, you know, a very strong, able to stick up for herself woman. And I don't think she saw that, even though I was a kid, and nobody likes that in a kid. I don't think she took it personally, and I don't think she necessarily saw that as a bad thing in the grand scheme of things, that I was strong-willed. And I think some of it comes from the fact that she was a very strong-willed person also.
You know, it brings up a very important observation for me, because I really believe that a lot of people have issues with mouthy kids because in some ways they feel maybe overpowered. Well, of course, disrespected, but feel overpowered and maybe perhaps somewhat intimidated by the kids, and they come off even more hard with them as a way of sort of protecting themselves to make sure that that child doesn't overpower them. And so when you say that Joyce was a strong woman, she, you know, she was not intimidated by that strength in you. Strength recognizes strength, and she didn't see you as a threat to her position, her role, her adult role, or anything. And so she could have said that part.
Oh, not even close. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not even close, because she was the adult. Why would I intimidate her? She was the adult. I mean, you know, and I think you bring up a good point is, you know, a lot of miscommunications or missteps in life do come from fear, but and maybe that was it, because there was no question she was the adult and in control, and I think she knew that within herself, and I think that did give her great power to affect us kids greatly, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Right, and power that's not abused, because I think there's one thing to be in power and another thing to feel like you're in control and use that as a form of abuse. And I think that's where the imbalance happens between a lot of adults and children. And so then with your best friend, definitely right there was just a sense of connectedness, because you had experienced some of the same things, perhaps. And so you saw yourselves in one another, I'm sure.
I think we did. And I mean, I think in other ways we were very different. Now she always, you know, looked at me like she took me under, she's a year older, so she took me under her wing and, you know, was very protective of me for very many years. So I think that was it too, like that it was, she liked to be in the mother role. I think I like to be in the caregiver role, and I think that, maybe in larger settings that does happen more than people realize, where kids kind of pair off and make their own parent-child relationships and nurture each other. Mm-hmm. So that was something there. I was like her little sister. So I think that was what that was about. And it's also, we had, you know, some of the similar interests. We both did decently at school and went to public school, and, you know, not everybody did. So there were those things, too, that were a little different about she and I. So,
And so there's another mess that you developed in the process of all of this as well, that when I was talking to you previously, there was another mask that we found out that you wore as a result of being going through this whole process, and what mask was that?
Well, first of all, I'm laughing because when I say it, then I'm going to feel a tremendous amount of pressure. And actually, you brought it up. You said, well, what about the mask of humor? And I laughed because I'm thinking, well, that's not a mask. I'm just funny. I'm hysterical. I don't know what you're talking about. It's not a mask. But it is a mask, and it is something that I've used. And, sarcasm and humor are something that I have used, and the more, probably uncomfortable or sad something is, usually the funnier it seems to me, or the funnier I express it, people always like, how are you laughing about that? I'm like, because it's funny, you don't see that? So that is another, there was another mask is my humor, except for now I'm like feeling tremendous pressure to be funny. So
no, it's just the reality that there are times, and the other thing, it was probably because the fact that you don't have a need to use it to the extreme of covering something at this point. When it comes, it just comes naturally. But a lot of times when someone is stressed and they're having to deal with painful situations, the humor covers up the pain as well. And one of the things that we had talked about was that even with a lot of our comedians, who are the ones who've had some of the most tragic incidences in their lives, have this crazy, crazy, wonderful sense of humor. But that's what got them through it, and they're also able to distract other people. That's why humor is therapeutic for most of us. So I think about the kids that act up in class, maybe not the one that's the mean or the mouthy one or, the bully, but the one who's the class clown, who's always cutting up and nevertheless still getting kicked out.
Yep. Well, and usually I do think the class clown is usually somebody who is dealing with issues themselves, and they are hiding them, whether they're having learning difficulties, or I would think that is very true. And I know I had problems at school because I had learning disabilities, and I didn't want to stand out as the stupid kid, so I'd much rather stand out as, the disobedient kid or the kid that refused to read because I didn't want to, rather than the kid that didn't read because I was going to stumble through every other word. So, yeah, we all come up with coping mechanisms, and humor is one, at least, that doesn't make people want to sock me in the mouth. So I guess I'm glad I've adapted that over time. So
the thing about the masks, and so for yours, the primary two being the angry person and the one with humor, was to be able to protect people from getting too close to touching the wounds of your pain and pulling those scabs off. So that was the protection. And one of the things that I share with my young people as well as the adults, it's understandable that you would have a mask, but masks, just like substances which people use to sort of ease the pain, once they become a substance of abuse and then you become addicted, they no longer serve the initial purpose. So did there come a time when your anger or your humor really didn't serve you as well as it had at one point?
Oh, wow. Now we get into, aging out and being 18 and having no skills and no family support, no means of support. And I spent several years very, very drunk and starting fights. So that did not serve me well. I've had a broken nose, a broken jaw. It's one of those things where when you hear a battered woman say, oh, I deserved it, and I always say my broken jaw, I deserved it, and people go, no, you didn't. I'm like, no, you've really never heard me. You I'm really angry. I totally started the fight I couldn't finish. That anger almost destroyed me, quite honestly, and that I lived, you know, to be 23 is shocking. And as a matter of fact, people stood around at my wedding and kept saying, wow, we really all thought we'd get together at your funeral. So that was a joyous thing. So, lots and lots of drinking and fighting and self-destructive, abusive behavior. And that was truly just flat-out rage. I was enraged. So, was that the answer you were looking for?
I was looking for whatever answer you had, but that makes sense. You know, that at that point, it stopped serving you at all, really. It became, you know, the more abuse to yourself. And I still take issue with the whole thing of deserving. I think our society is cruel when we say, you know, someone deserves something. Your behavior might have prompted it, but you as a person didn't deserve, one, to be treated like that, nor to be treating yourself like that. So that's a whole other topic.
Okay, well, I won't say, I guess I'm not trying to say deserve, but I totally, you know, my broken jaw especially, I totally started the situation. I totally didn't stop. I totally pushed it to the edge. And I think I was trying to self-destruct. I think I was literally trying to get somebody to put me out of my misery. And thankfully, they didn't. Thankfully, I never accomplished that. But there were some very dark years for me, very dark.
Yes. So for someone, you know, it really got me when you said even your peers said that they didn't think you would live to be past 23. I listened to teachers. I listened to people in the community talk about our kids. And said, that kid is going to be dead before he's 15 if he keeps it up like that. And they really have nothing positive to say. And then other people will say, you know, well, that's good for them. They got what they deserved in those exact words. Or one day somebody's going to teach them a lesson. And they seem to think that the lesson comes in adding more pain. And I really don't believe that. What is it that you felt that turned things around for you, where you really start to realize that the pain wasn't the answer?
As crazy as it sounds, I literally one day, and I am not joking, I think it was, you know, an epiphany or like a lightning bolt from God. I was like, you know, if I just stop acting crazy, I bet my life would be a whole lot better. Because I'm really, you know, not crazy. I've learned crazy behavior. And it didn't happen overnight, don't get me wrong. That's not what happened. But I started slowly making different decisions. And slowly, like my first reaction to a situation, I would go to take, you know, with the adrenaline, what my instincts were, and I would step back and say, okay, well, that's how I instinctively react to this situation. And since it's never, ever, ever served me, what else can I do? And I do think it was the grace of God, so don't get me wrong. But somewhere around 22, I just started saying, you know what? I need to start thinking and behaving differently or else I will be dead. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to say it was easy. But in some sense, it was easy when I really understood, like, I get to change this. I get to think differently. I get to behave differently. I am in control of this. You know, this isn't my parents doing. This isn't the system's doing. Or maybe they're doing. But it really doesn't matter because now I'm 22 and I'm miserable. And I'm stuck with myself. So now I have to figure out how I can live. And I think that, you know, like that awareness that I was in control, that I had to change, I changed my life completely. But I'm not saying that was easy.
No, it wasn't easy. But you made that decision. You also realized that you had the power to do something, that you were no longer powerless. And I'm almost willing to bet that somewhere along the line, people probably had been dropping little seeds of that thought in your heart, in your mind throughout the years, and one day it just probably sprouted.
Oh, absolutely. And again, like I said, I've had these everyday angels. They might not have seen the fruits of their labor at the moment, but they came back. The messages came back. And when you said that, the one I think of is a teacher of mine, Wayne, who always said, you know, when you learn to use the system instead of buck the system, you're going to get a whole lot further. Well, that was just blobbity, blobbity, blah to me at the time because I had no idea what he was talking about. But the truth is, he was right. You know, when you go through the proper channels, when you're nice and cooperative to people, when you know the rules, when you follow the rules to the best of your ability and better maybe than the people who are supposed to enforce them, then, yeah, you know, it does work. You can use the system instead of bucking the system. And that is funny because that was something he always said, and I was like 12, and I was like, yeah, right, whatever. You have no idea what you're talking about. You're stupid. But somewhere around 25, I went, oh, that's what he was talking about. I get it.
Yeah.
Pardon?
I missed your last statement.
Oh, I said I got lots of messages like that, and I was lucky enough to, you know, that I did have support and I did have counseling, and I was, you know, in one of the first supervised independent living program. So I did get a lot of messages. They just didn't really sink in at the time. And that's, you know, the thing I'd like to tell parents and staff is keep doing what you're doing, because even though you don't feel like you're making a difference and you don't see a difference, you know, one day that kid's going to wake up 10, 15 years from now and it's all going to make sense to them and you will have saved their life.
You summed that up. I was going to ask you that at the end, but you stated that very clearly, and we will repeat that at the end. But that is my message to the adults, to never, ever, ever give up. People say, I'm not going to deal with them, and I'm not going to waste my breath, and I just keep saying it's not a waste. You know, just keep having their best interest at heart and have faith and believe that a change will come. And yeah, I'm sure there's a message for the young people as well, but I want to address some of the questions that have come through on our chat board, and then we have a few callers on the line, and I'm going to allow them to come on, because believe it or not, we only have 20 minutes left. Can you believe it?
Wow.
Wow.
See, I told you I can talk.
Well, we knew that you could. That's why I wanted you here, and I love the message that you're bringing, so thank you so much for sharing. Well, one of the first questions that we have, a comment from another former foster youth states that you remind her of herself, and that you talk about how you often become caregivers, and that's something that she can relate to. And she wants to know, someone else wants to know, when is humor? I lost my spot.
That's okay. I'll wait.
Okay. It says, da-da-da-da-da. I was hoping people would be able to put their questions or comments in color so I wouldn't have to scroll through. I could see. But the question was something about when does humor become, and I know the person is probably sitting there trying to tell me through the telephone. I am going to come back to that. But the person, the former foster youth.
I see it. Pardon? How do you know when humor is natural or a place to hide?
Okay. Oh, that's right. You're on the chat. Oh, good. Thank you. Good looking out.
Okay. Okay. How do you know when humor is natural or a good place to hide? Well, I don't know. Do you have feelings on that? I'm thinking some of it must have to come natural, or else you couldn't hide there because you wouldn't be funny. We've all met people who aren't funny.
Well, I think that the humor can be natural. It's just like we have hair, most of us. some of us have hair, and it's natural. But when you cover it over your face to hide a pimple or some feature that you don't like, then it's unnatural. So if you have humor and you're able to see the humor in things, but you use it to block any discussion about what's really going on and it becomes inappropriate, I think that's when it's really a mask. Because I think most
right.
a lot of people see humor in things, but when it comes up inappropriately to disrupt what could otherwise be a meaningful exchange between the hearts of people to touch their hearts, but someone will throw something out to get you to laugh so you perhaps forget about what it was or to relieve the tension. You know, that's really my thoughts about that. So it
as
doesn't
a distraction.
Mean. Right. And it's a distractor or a buffer. And so you don't have to, just because you have it as a natural gift doesn't mean it can't be a mask. It can still be something that you use, but in appropriate time and place, as long as you're willing to address your real issues. Okay.
Well,
and our other foster youth wanted to know, what are you doing with your life now?
A lot and nothing at all. I have three beautiful kids. I have a 12-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 2-year-old who have not disrupted me, which is amazing. They might have actually
during
fallen.
This call.
yes, exactly. I think they fell asleep. So I am a mother to them. I work coaching gymnastics. Before I had my children, I was a certified ophthalmic technician, so I was the person at the eye doctor's office that worked out and gave you the prescription for your glasses and examined you before the doctor. So I did that before I had kids. Now that I have kids, I'm coaching gymnastics so that my husband or myself can be home with the kids, except for now with the economy, he works out of town, so that doesn't actually work, but... that was the intention behind it.
All right. Wonderful. And you also have a block spot. Would you like to tell and perhaps even type it in on the chat line where your block spot is for people? I read some wonderful stories that you shared there that I think are going to be an awesome book. As you reflect back on some of your experiences and even as situations come up in your life now, tell our listeners the name and the website of your blog space.
It is. My blog space is http://SundayCoffron, SundayCoffron.blogspot.com. And it's kind of a mishmash of topical stuff to foster care and adoption. You know, some issues mixed with, I try to put in a little parenting anecdotes or just things I find amusing, and I do a little backstory, or if I, you know, a blog post, say I want to talk about shame, I talk about an incident from the past where I was ashamed. So I kind of mix it up. I know most blogs stick to, like, one subject and one subject only, but I always think, God, I don't want people to come to my blog and always be like, wow, that was deep, or that was too heavy. So I try to put a little something funny in there, or some news clips. And you talked about pharmaceuticals. I did a little piece on a New York Times article about pharmaceuticals because that's another one of my pet issues is, you know, labeling children, medicating children, you know, sometimes unnecessary. Sometimes people really do need medication, but that is one of my little That is one of my little issues is just really trying to let kids be kids. Like I said, I can thank Joyce for that. And kids who survive trauma, you know, have issues. But they're also real little human beings that have real feelings and really bad things really happen to them. That doesn't mean the rest of their lives need to be ruined or revolve around that specific trauma. So I'm trying to kind of bring that out, and I'm kind of trying to bring out things that maybe people can relate to, maybe not the specific situation, but the feelings. And then, like I said, sometimes I just try to make people laugh, or sometimes I try to make people laugh while I'm talking about issues. So I'm doing that, and yes, someday I hope to get some of this down. I mean, I've met some wonderful people along the way. I know that's not everybody's care experience. I do realize that, but I have been truly, truly blessed and lucky to have gone through an unfortunate childhood, an unfortunate situation, and really found lots of people who cared about me enough to go the extra mile. And, you know, someday I'd really like to thank them by doing more than just being alive.
You know what? So. You're thanking them by doing what you're doing right now.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. My desire is that this will touch the lives of many, those who have been in the situation and those who have the opportunity to touch the lives of someone that is going through something. And by your sharing, other people will also receive their healing. I'm going to go to a couple of our callers, because they've been holding on for a while, and I'm not sure if they want to speak, but I'm going to give them the opportunity. So we're going to go our first caller, because we have 10 minutes, and I do want to leave a closing statement, especially for our youth. So I'm going to call on our caller number 2, if I know how to do this correctly. Okay. I just muted them out. Okay. We have 2 callers from the 248 area code.
Anyone okay. One is probably my husband. 948 is a 943 number. That's my husband. I doubt he wants to talk to me.
Let's see. I'm trying to unmute him. Caller on the air. Is this the husband of Miss Sunday? He probably has us muted. I hear that he was also one of your angels, though.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my husband, what he dealt with for the first few years of our marriage deserves a medal. I was still working things out and still really did not know how to be close to people or trust people. And he truly has stuck by me and loved me just for exactly who I am, flaws and all. And, you know, I don't think I've always made it easy for him. And that unconditional love has really allowed me to grow and bloom as a person and feel secure and step behind the mask and step out of the box and, you know, there was a point in time where, you know, it didn't take much to set me to, you know, telling you, you know, getting somebody told. And it's really, his love and support has really been a calming influence in my life. And I thank God for him every day.
Awesome. And actually, we're going to be doing a program in a few months on developing healthy relationships, because the other thing that I feel that happens when you come into the foster care system, it affects one's ability to develop healthy, loving, intimate relationships, and that becomes a real issue, and I'm seeing it being played out in a lot of the young people that I've worked with as children who are now adults and have gone through 2 and 3 marriages already, some who just can't even commit to a relationship because it's so scary. So perhaps you can come back and share with us, and who knows, maybe your husband will join us for that one as well. So we have actually all of our callers unmuted on this end, so if someone has something to say, you're more than welcome to speak up now. And for people in our chat room, please send us other comments or questions. Anyone there? My computer is trying to freeze, so we're going by not even Braille at this point. So since no one has anything to say at this point, what is it that you would like to say to our young people? Those who are coming out, and I would say even from 11 to 18, because you were in the system for 7 years, what would you say to our young people about
hang
the
mask? Hang in there. Oh, about the masks?
Uh-huh.
You know, and I really almost want to say, that to some extent those masks are necessary, and that but don't let them become who you think you are. Sometimes you do need defense mechanisms. Sometimes you do need to protect yourself, but don't let that become who you are. Don't get your inner person lost in the facade. Don't let that become a way of life. But I'm not going to tell people to actually, in my opinion, to do away with, because I think sometimes there are times when you do need to protect yourself, because you are vulnerable. But just don't let that be who you are. Don't lose sight of the good in you.
Exactly. Don't let that define you.
Let that define you. Oh, go ahead.
Be willing to take risks with people who might be able to deal with what's under the mask and not hurt you.
Yes. And you know, there's a lot of trying that goes on with people that have come in our situation and testing. And at some point, you got to just stop testing people and just trust. Because if you don't let people into your heart, you're missing out on a whole world of people that will love you. They're not perfect. They're not going to love you exactly the way you want them to every day, but they're going to love you most days really well.
Yes, absolutely. Two other questions, and we have 4 minutes left. One asks, are you doing any advocacy for former foster youth?
You know, formally, not as much as I should. I just got back in touch with the Foster Care Alumni Association, so I hope to start getting a chapter together here in Michigan so we can, I love the legislation they made out in California. I need to really educate myself on how we start the ball rolling here with our legislature. So I would like to do a little more than just blogging and talking about that kind of issue and doing some outreach, the Thanksgivings and things that the other Foster Care Alumni Associations across the country have been doing. I would love to do that.
Wonderful. And hopefully we'll connect in other ways, but especially with that, because we are really working with the Northern California region of the Foster Care Alumni Association here. So hopefully there will be lots of opportunities to interact. There are two other questions, but I'm going to leave those because we're going to do one on parenting, and I know it's not going to be an answer which is very quickly, that you can quickly be answered by you. And one is, what methods do you now use in raising your children, and do you forgive your parents, and how long did it take you? So for the person who asked that, hopefully you're going to stay tuned in and not let us forget those questions, but we do actually have two programs that I've already looked at and dealing specifically with issues about dealing with birth parents, as well as when you're taking on trying to learn healthy ways of parenting yourself. But those are excellent questions. I appreciate your asking them. And any other suggestions that anyone has about future topics would be greatly appreciated. So we're winding down our show at this point. First of all, I want to thank Sundi for being here. Awesome interview. I love it, and I'm looking forward for us collaborating on many projects. So thank you so very much, and
thank you for having me.
A little lady, tell me ahead, 9 seconds left. So for those who are listening, I want to thank you. Please leave your comments on our page, on our blog page, not on our chat room, but on the blog page when people come to see. And also make sure that you click follow us. And that way you can sign up, you can get notifications when we are having other events or questions that are there. They will come directly into your inbox. And also you can share this information with others. You can come back and also listen to this archive. So we want to thank everyone. I'm loving this, and I'm so glad we got the additional half hour, because 30 minutes just wasn't enough. We thank our former guest from last week, Matt Anderson, and we're going to make up the other 30 minutes for you. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Take care and do something special for a child's heart. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
heavenly mother's crying. These children are dying at the hands of the other child. I know her heart is breaking, feel the earth is shaking. That river flows from the tears she cries. She cries, she cries. Rachel's sleeping for her children.
Rachel's sleeping.
For lost someone's got to save them.
Save the children.
And if you say that love the answer, why don't we begin? Or will we just end? On the streets of Brazil, children gathered, shot, killed, begging, mister, can you spare a dime? A dime.